painted onto tarpaulins. Schwieger maneuvered for a torpedo attack. He ordered a bronze torpedo, set to run at a depth of 8 feet. When U-20 was about 330 yards away from the steamer, Schwieger gave the order to fire. He missed. The bubbles rising to the surface from the torpedo's compressed air engine revealed its path. As the torpedo track moved toward the target, the ship began a sudden acceleration and veered away. As best Schwieger could tell, the torpedo went past or under the stern. Now, it was Schwieger's turn to flee. He feared the ship might be armed. After the shot, I turned around hard and ran away in order to avoid the danger of being fired upon, he wrote. For this reason, I did not consider a second attack. Steamer disappeared quickly in the fog. In his log entry at 8:10 that night, he contemplated what had occurred. The torpedo had seemed to lose speed as it approached the target, he wrote. I had considered a miss out of the question, even after the torpedo had been fired, considering our favorable position and the fact that the steamer could not make much headway. Remarkably, the ship had then managed to accelerate from a dead stop to make its escape. Over the next hour, the dense fog returned, and once again forced Schwieger to submerge. This was the end of his 6th day at sea, and all he had sunk was a 99-ton sailboat. Sighting. From Head of Kinsale to Admiralty, May 5th, 1915. Sent 7:55 p.m. Received 8:52 p.m. Small boat containing 5 men southeast 1 mile hoisted oar with a garment attached. Steam drifter D-145 took crew on board making Kinsale. Coast Guard Kinsale informed. Room 40. Schwieger revealed. First came a report of gunfire in the fog, sent on the evening of Wednesday, May 5th, from a station perched on the old head of Kinsale, a promontory that jutted into the Celtic Sea near Queenstown, Ireland. The old head was well known to mariners, who often used it to fix their locations. Kinsale followed this message with a report that a schooner, the Earl of Latham, had been sunk off the old head. This was relayed to Blinker Hall and First Sea Lord Fisher, temporarily in charge of the Admiralty. Churchill was expected to arrive in Paris by midnight. The new message, received in London at 10:46 p.m. and noted in a record of U-20's travels compiled by Room 40, stated that the schooner's crew had been rescued and brought to Kinsale. The crew reported that when they had last seen the submarine, it was heading southeast toward a large steamer. At about the same time, another telegram reached the Admiralty, this from the Naval Center at Queenstown. The captain of a British ship, the Caio Romano, was reporting that a torpedo had been fired at his vessel off Fastnet Rock. He never saw the submarine that fired it. This, too, was noted in Room 40 and relayed to Hall and Fisher. Now came a fourth message, also circulated, that a submarine had been sighted 12 miles south of the Daunt Rock Light, a lightship anchored outside the entrance to Queenstown Harbor. The time of the sighting was 9:30 p.m. By comparing the locations of these attacks with previously intercepted wireless reports, it should have become obvious to someone, to Chief of Staff Oliver, Captain Hall or Fisher, that the U-boat involved was Kapitänleutnant Walter Schwieger's U-20, and that Schwieger was now operating in the heart of one of Britain's primary sea lanes. A detailed record of U-20's travels kept by Room 40 included a precise location for that evening, 51.32 north, 8.22 west. These coordinates put the U-boat just south-southeast of the old head of Kinsale. The Admiralty was well aware the Lusitania would soon traverse these same waters, but made no effort to provide specifics of the night's events directly to Captain Turner. Meanwhile, the closely watched HMS Orion continued on its course to Scapa Flow, guarded all the while by the four destroyers assigned as escorts. They accompanied the dreadnought until it was safely in the Atlantic and heading north before beginning their own return voyages. At that point, the four destroyers were within range of U-20's last position and the path the Lusitania soon would follow on its way to Liverpool. No attempt was made to divert the destroyers. One, the HMS Boyne, went directly back to Devonport. The other three returned via the Scilly Islands. The Orion continued north on a zigzag course at 18 knots, a speed deemed more than sufficient to outrun a U-boat. Now 5 days into its voyage, the Lusitania made its way toward Britain alone, with no escort offered or planned, and no instruction to take the newly opened and safer North Channel route. This despite the fact that the ship carried a valuable cache of rifle cartridges and desperately needed shrapnel shells. The absence of any protective measures may simply have been the result of a lapse of attention, with Churchill off in France and Fisher consumed by other matters and seemingly drifting toward madness. It would take on a more sinister cast, however, in light of a letter that Churchill had sent earlier in the year to the head of England's Board of Trade, Walter Runciman, in which Churchill wrote that it was most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores, in the hopes especially of embroiling the United States with Germany. Though no one said it explicitly, Britain hoped the United States would at some point feel moved to join the Allies, and in so doing, tip the balance irrevocably in their favor. After noting that Germany's submarine campaign had sharply reduced traffic from America, Churchill told Runciman, "For our part, we want the traffic. The more, the better. And if some of it gets into trouble, better still." Lusitania, Helpful Young Ladies. At 5:30 a.m. Thursday, May 6th, passengers in first-class staterooms arrayed along the port side of the Lusitania's boat deck, A-deck, heard a commotion outside. Theodate Pope, in A-10, recalled being wakened by shouts and the scuffling of feet. Metal clanked against metal. Ropes moved through squeaking tackle. All this was mingled with muffled curses and the sounds of men working at a task requiring strength, which the crew possessed, and coordination, which it did not. With the ship about a day away from entering the Celtic Sea, Captain Turner had ordered the crew to uncover and swing out all the ship's conventional lifeboats, meaning those that hung from davits along both sides of the boat deck. The two emergency boats were already in position. Turner was being prudent. If an emergency were to occur, the boats could be launched from this position more quickly and with less hazard than if they were still locked in their deep-sea positions. At this hour, few passengers would be out on deck and thus would be less likely to interfere with the effort or, worse, be injured, though Turner risked causing annoyance by awakening them so early. And these were some of the most expensive staterooms on the ship. Third Officer John Lewis, who ran the daily lifeboat drills, also directed this operation. First, he said, "We mustered the cooks, the stewards, the watch of sailors on deck, and any other daymen that we could raise." The crew began with the boats on the port side. Lewis climbed to the navigation deck and positioned himself at its midpoint, outside the Marconi room, so that he could monitor the entire operation at once. 6 to 8 men were assigned to each boat. To avoid tangled falls and guy lines, all the boats had to be swung out at once, according to Lewis. Next, the men, some 80 in all, shifted to the starboard side, and repeated the process. Lewis then dismissed the cooks and stewards, but ordered the deck crew to secure the guy lines and pile the falls in tidy Flemish coils. Last, he had the men make sure that each boat contained its required complement of survival gear, including oars, mast, sails, matches, sea anchor, lamp, provisions, and drinking water. The process did not go smoothly. First-class passenger Joseph Myers, up early, watched the crew work. "The men were not efficient," he said. "I saw them trying to throw out the boats, trying to break away the boats from the davits, and it seemed to me that they were not equal to it. They were clumsy, handling the ropes. They were bossed by some petty officer. I don't know who it was, but the men did not look to me as if they had been handling the boats before. They handled the ropes and falls like men building a house. They looked more like day laborers than seamen." Passengers who awoke later that morning were greeted by the sight of all the boats swung out and uncovered, with no explanation posted. For most, the change was of minor interest. Some may not even have noticed. For others, it was disconcerting. "On Thursday morning, I felt rather uneasy when I discovered that the lifeboats were hung over the side of the ship," wrote Jane McFarquhar of Stratford, Connecticut. "On inquiry, I was informed that it was essential that they should be so, according to law. I thought it rather strange that they had not been put ready after clearing New York, instead of waiting until we were so near the other side. I noticed the other passengers did not seem to bother, so I also began to forget the lifeboats." Nellie Houston, adding a few more paragraphs to her diary-like letter, wrote, "This morning we have all the lifeboats swung out ready for emergencies. It's awful to think about, but I guess there is some danger." She noted that she and fellow passengers expected British naval vessels to rendezvous with the ship that day to provide escort. She switched to cheerier observations. "What a crowd there are in the boat, and all English. I was so pleased to see the Union Jacks on this boat when we were in New York. There are quite a lot of distinguished people in the first class, but of course you couldn't touch them with a soft pole. There is a Vanderbilt, one or two bankers. I have made lots of friends, and if it wasn't for the worry, I could say we've had a lovely trip." The deckmen did the usual sailoring to maintain the ship, a process that never ended. Every morning a group of sailors cleaned the brass and glass in the portholes that opened onto the decks. There was always a peak of rust that needed sanding and painting. The brine and dried mist that collected on the deck rails overnight had to be ragged off in the morning so that the rails shone and did not spoil the dresses and suits of passengers. All the ship's plants had to be watered, including the 21 large palm trees that stood at the heads of stairwells. Deck chairs had to be straightened to avoid the haphazard look of a wedding after all the guests had left. Seaman Morton was assigned to touch up the paint on the hull of one of the lifeboats. The crew must have swung the boat back in for this, because Morton had to lie underneath to administer the paint. The paint was gray and was known as crab fat. It was a messy task. "We were not issued with paintbrushes. We had instead a swab of waste," meaning a rag, "and a paint pot into which we dipped the waste and then applied it to the hull of the lifeboat." Morton was hard at work when he heard the sound of small shoes charging toward him and looked out from under the boat to see two girls intently watching. These were Anna and Gwendolyn Allen, ages 15 and 16, the two daughters of Lady Hugh Montague Allen of Montreal, one of the ship's most prominent passengers. The three occupied a regal suite on B deck, which included two bedrooms, bathroom, dining room, and parlor. The Allens traveled with two maids, who stayed in a tiny room squeezed between one of the ship's funnels and the dome of the first-class dining salon. The girls were a popular and vivid presence aboard. I could not help thinking what lovely children they were, and how beautifully dressed, Morton wrote. I seem to remember the eldest one was wearing a white accordion-pleated skirt and sailor blouse. One girl asked, "What are you doing, sailor?" Morton answered, "I am painting the lifeboat." "May we help you?" Morton noted again the girl's clothing and also the sound of heavier steps quickly approaching. These the footfalls of a woman who appeared to be a nanny. The woman did not look pleased. Morton said, "I don't think this is a job for little girls." The eldest girl, clearly accustomed to having her way, grabbed the improvised brush, which was soaked with paint, and started applying it to the boat and, in the process, applied it to her clothing as well. "I was horrified," Morton wrote. He heard the still heavier footsteps of his approaching supervisor, the bosun, or senior deckman, coming along at the double. The girls fled, and so did Morton. He eased out from under the boat toward the water and climbed over the side to the deck below. I did not feel there was any purpose in stopping to argue the point with either the irate bosun or the extremely angry-looking nanny. A boy named Robert Kay missed all the morning's excitement. Kay, 7 years old, was an American citizen from the Bronx in New York City, traveling to England with his British mother, Margarita Belcher Kay, who was in an advanced phase of pregnancy. She wanted badly to return to her parents' home in England to have the baby, and was willing to brave the passage, despite the German warning and her own tendency to get seasick. By midweek, Robert himself had begun to feel poorly. The ship's surgeon examined him and diagnosed a full-blown case of measles. The boy, he said, would have to spend the rest of the voyage in quarantine 2 decks down. The Kays were traveling in second class, but his mother chose to go below as well, to room with her son. The monotony was crushing, but there was at least a porthole through which the boy could watch the sea. Captain Turner ordered the usual mid-morning lifeboat drill. The team of picked crewmen climbed into one of the emergency boats as an audience of passengers looked on. One witness was George Kessler, the Champagne King, who went up to the sailor in charge and told him, "It's all right drilling your crew, but why don't you drill your passengers?" The man replied, "Why not tell Captain Turner, sir?" Kessler resolved to do so. U-20. Spectacle. Thursday morning, May 6th, found U-20 advancing slowly along the southwest coast of Ireland into waters mariners knew as the St. George's Channel. Though the term channel connotes a narrow body of water, the St. George's at its broadest was about 90 miles wide, tapering to 45 miles between Carnsore Point on the Irish coast and St. David's Head in Wales. A lightship was anchored at the Irish side to steer ships away from a notorious hazard, the Conningbeg Rock, routinely misspelled by telegraph and wireless operators as Koningberg or Conningbeg. Beyond this point, the waters broadened again to form the Irish Sea, Mór Éireann, with Liverpool another 250 nautical miles to the north and east. Even at Schwieger's best speed of 15 knots, he would need another 16 hours to reach his assigned patrol zone. But the weather was not cooperating. Persistent fog had forced him to remain submerged throughout the night. Just before 8 a.m., he found signs of clearing and brought the boat to the surface, but did so using only its hydroplanes. He kept the diving tanks filled with seawater in case of emergency. The boat moved through striations of heavy fog. A steamship appeared ahead, off to starboard. It flew no flag and showed no other indicator of registry. Schwieger ordered his gun crew on deck for a surface attack. Despite the poor visibility, some sharp-eyed soul aboard the steamer spotted the submarine. The ship turned hard and fled at full speed. Schwieger raced after it, his gun crew firing round after round. Two shells hit the steamer, but it continued to run. The ship entered a fog bank and disappeared from view. Schwieger followed. Clarity returned. Schwieger's men resumed fire. U-20 was making 15 knots, the steamer probably only 8 to 10. The attack went on for nearly 2 hours, with U-20 gradually gaining, until one shell struck the target's bridge. This proved persuasive. The steamship stopped and lowered its boats. One foundered, Schwieger saw, but three others pulled away, full to capacity. Schwieger brought the submarine closer. He fired a bronze torpedo into the hull from a distance of 500 meters, 550 yards. It exploded at a point opposite what Schwieger believed to be the ship's engine room. "Effect slight," he wrote. The ship sagged at the stern, but did not sink. Schwieger's gun crew began firing at the ship's waterline as he brought U-20 slowly around to its stern. The ship's name had been painted over, but up close Schwieger was able to read it. Candidate. His ship identification book showed it to be a British freighter of about 5,000 tons, owned by the Harrison Line of Liverpool, a company prone to giving ships such romantic names as Auditor, Administrator, and Electrician. Schwieger's men continued firing until the ship's bow rose high out of the water and the stern began to sink. He recorded the latitude and longitude of the wreck, which put it 20 miles south of the Koningsberg lightship, at about the middle of the narrowest portion of the St. George's Channel. The time was 10:30 a.m. 10 minutes later, he sighted another potential target coming over the horizon, this one the biggest yet, on a course that would converge with his. Fog obscured the ship. Schwieger ordered full speed and set a course that he anticipated would put U-20 ahead of the ship and in position to fire a torpedo. The big steamer burst from the fog, moving fast. Schwieger saw now that it was a passenger liner of about 14,000 tons. A true prize. He ordered a fast dive and raced at the highest speed his battery-powered engines could muster, 9 knots. But this proved not nearly enough. The ship was still 2 miles off and moving at full speed. Schwieger realized that the best he could do would be to position U-20 so that a torpedo would strike the liner at a glancing 20-degree angle, too oblique to be successful. He called off the attack. Although he didn't name the ship in his log, the liner was the Arabic of the White Star Line, which had owned the Titanic. An hour later, shortly before 1 o'clock, Schwieger spotted yet another target, ahead and to port. He set up his attack. This time he chose one of the newer G6 torpedoes and ordered its depth set at 3 meters, about 10 feet. He fired from a distance of 300 meters. The torpedo struck the ship at a point below its forward mast. The bow took on water, but the ship stayed afloat. Its crew fled in boats. Schwieger surfaced. He determined that the vessel was an English freighter, the Centurion, about 6,000 tons, owned by the same line that owned the freighter he had sunk earlier in the day. The fog again began to build. Schwieger did not want to take a chance that the Centurion would survive. He fired a second torpedo to make foundering sure. This, too, exploded on contact, and Schwieger heard the telltale hiss of air that fled the ship as water filled its hull. U-boat commanders always found this a satisfying moment. Kapitän Leutnant Forstner, in his memoir, described how the air escapes with a shrill whistle from every possible aperture, and the sound resembles the shriek of a steam siren. This is a wonderful spectacle to behold. Often at this point, stricken ships gave one last exhalation as water filled their boiler rooms, causing a final explosion and releasing a cloud of black smoke and soot, known to U-boat commanders as the Black Soul. Schwieger did not wait to see the ship disappear below the surface. The fog had grown too thick. At 2:15 p.m., he submerged and set a course that would take U-20 well out to sea so that he could recharge its batteries in safety and consider how next to proceed. Schwieger faced a decision. His fuel was running low, surprisingly so, and he had yet to reach his assigned hunting zone off Liverpool, still nearly a day's voyage away. Lusitania, Life After Death. That Thursday afternoon, Theodate Pope and Edwin Friend sat in their deck chairs, enjoying the fine weather and blue vista. They were not lovers, but Theodate spent most of her time in Friend's company. While on deck, Friend read aloud to her from a book, Henri Borgson's Matière et Mémoire, or Matter and Memory, published in 1896. Broadly, it dealt with the relationship between mind and body. Bergson, a past president of Britain's Society for Psychical Research, was sympathetic to the idea that some element of an individual persisted after death. Theodate, too, was a member of the Society, an organization founded in London in 1882, not by crackpots or would-be mediums, but by philosophers, writers, scientists, and journalists who sought to bring the principles of scientific rigor to the investigation of paranormal phenomena. Its membership included dozens of scientific and literary notables, among them H.G. Wells, Mark Twain, William James, and Oliver Lodge, a leading British physicist who would lose his own son to the war in September 1915 and spend the rest of his life trying to reach him beyond the veil. From time to time, Theodate had assisted Lodge and James in an investigation of Mrs. Piper, the medium, for which James convened 75 seances. The medium's apparent talents so resisted his attempts to debunk her skills that James came to believe she might be legitimate. "If you wish to upset the law that all crows are black," he wrote famously, "you must not seek to show that no crows are. It is enough if you prove the single crow to be white. My own white crow is Mrs. Piper." Theodate also participated in seances independently of William James, and in an unpublished memoir described a 1909 sitting with another famed medium, Eusapia Palladino, during which Theodate claimed her own turban levitated from her scalp and settled on the table in front of her. Palladino was subsequently proven to be a very talented fraud. Theodate began serious study of the powers of the mind and the occult in her 30s. In 1900, at 33, she read her first issues of Proceedings of the Society for Psychical Research, which included investigations of supposed hauntings and incidences of survival, the Society's preferred term for life after death. The proceedings were also where Sigmund Freud in 1912 published his first detailed articulation of his theory of subconscious thought. Theodate joined the Society in 1904, and soon afterward began helping William James with his investigation of Mrs. Piper. James's brother Henry, though the author of 10 ghost stories, including Turn of the Screw, scorned spiritualism and paranormal dabbling. In 1907, the year Theodate turned 40, she helped found a new institute for psychical research in New York and contributed $25,000, over $600,000 today. Her traveling companion, Edwin Friend, had been editor of the institute's journal until a decidedly non-astral conflict over what sorts of articles to publish led to his removal. Though only in his 20s, Friend had already received bachelor's and master's degrees from Harvard and had taught classics at Princeton, Harvard, and the University of Berlin. Theodate, angered by his removal, resigned from the Institute's board. Her reason for traveling with him now on the Lusitania was to visit Oliver Lodge and others in London to seek support for the founding of a wholly new American society. Bergson's book was in French, but Friend translated as he read. This was no mean feat. Matter and Memory was a stupefying read in any language. Yet there they sat, contentedly filling the warm afternoon air with murmured language and knowing smiles, grasping the ungraspable. There were passages that illustrated so wonderfully some of the common difficulties in communication, Theodate wrote, and by communication she meant contact with the dead. They were most illuminating, and I could see the vividness of the inspiration they were to Mr. Friend. And as we sat side by side in our deck chairs, I marveled to myself that such a man as Mr. Friend had been found to carry on the investigations. I felt very deeply the quality of my respect and admiration for him. He was endowed so richly in heart and mind. She saw Friend as an intellectual helpmate, and believed that in coming years he would be an important, albeit platonic, presence in her life. Among the younger crowd, shipboard life gained a new intensity with the end of the voyage so near. New-made friends asked each other to sign memento books. Flirtations became more flirty, the ongoing sporting competitions more zesty, with prizes offered at the ship's barber shop. The boundaries between families began to blur. Children roamed the deck in packs led by stewardesses. One stewardess had charge of 22 children, whom she watched while their parents dined. Ethel Moore Lamping Lines, 34, traveling with her husband Stanley, befriended a young couple from Toronto who were on their way home to Scotland with their three children, a toddler and a pair of one-and-a-half-year-old twins. All around us were nice, little growing families, Mrs. Lines wrote, and all so happy. She and a friend joked about what to do if the ship were attacked. Our stewardess laughed, Mrs. Lines recalled, and said we would not go down, but up, as we were well loaded with munitions. That afternoon, Captain Turner and Staff Captain Anderson toured the ship to make sure all the lifeboats were in fact swung out and ready for lowering. Turner also ordered Anderson to see that all the ship's portholes were closed, up to B deck, and that all bulkhead doors likewise were closed. As of noon Thursday, the ship was 465 miles west of Ireland's Fastnet Rock, and moving at 21 knots. U-20. Change of Plan. On Thursday afternoon, with U-20 submerged and headed out to sea, Schwieger made his decision. He resolved to abandon his effort to reach Liverpool, despite his orders. Within the culture of U-boat leadership, this was his prerogative. Out of touch with superiors and friendly vessels, only a commander could know how his patrol was unfolding and what threats or challenges he faced. Still, Schwieger devoted nearly a full page of his war log to his rationale. The weather was the biggest factor in his decision. The barometer, and the fog that had dogged his course all day and the previous night, and the strangely calm weather, here he used the lovely German word Windstille, suggested to him that the fog would linger for days. The poor visibility, he wrote, makes it impossible to sight the numerous enemy patrols, trawlers, and destroyers, which may be expected in the St. George's Channel and the Irish Sea. Therefore, we will be in constant danger and compelled to travel submerged. He assumed that any troop transports leaving Liverpool would do so at night with destroyer escorts. The only way to spot these ships was to remain on the surface, he wrote, but doing so in fog and darkness was too dangerous, both because of the risk of being run over And because the destroyers, fast and heavily armed, could not be spotted in time for him to evade attack. Also, he had only 3 torpedoes left, of which he wanted to hold 2 in reserve for his return journey, standard practice for U-boat commanders. And then there was the fuel problem. If he continued forward to Liverpool, his supply would run so low that he would be unable to return by the same route that had brought him here. He would be forced to take the North Channel between Scotland and Ireland. While the route had become much safer for British merchant ships, for U-boats it had become increasingly dangerous. The last time he had gone that way, he had encountered heavy patrols and unceasing danger. He vowed not to do it again under any circumstances. He planned to continue attacking ships, he wrote, but in waters well short of Liverpool, at the entrance to a different passage, the Bristol Channel, through which ships traveled to reach the English port cities of Swansea, Cardiff, and Bristol, since chances for favorable attacks are better here and enemy defensive measures lesser than in the Irish Sea near Liverpool. Though he had only 1 torpedo available for immediate use, apart from his 2 in reserve, he had plenty of shells. He resolved to continue attacks until 2/5 of his remaining fuel was used up. But once again, he was stymied by the weather. At 6:10 that evening, he looked through his periscope and again found only fog, with visibility limited to 30 yards in any direction. He continued out to sea, beyond the heaviest lanes of traffic, to spend the night. He planned to surface the next morning, Friday, to run his diesels and recharge his batteries, in preparation for the day's hunting. Lusitania. Messages. There was dinner, of course, as elaborate and filling as usual, though now more appreciated, given that this was the second-to-last dinner of the voyage before arrival in Liverpool on Saturday morning. As the passengers dined, one of the ship's Marconi men picked up a message chattering through the ether. The time was 7:50 p.m. The message, sent en clair, meaning in plain English, was from the Admiralty's office in Queenstown, Ireland. The first version must have been distorted, for the Lusitania's operator asked Queenstown to send it again. The repeat was sent at 7:56. Moments later, Captain Turner had the message in hand. Submarines active off south coast of Ireland. At about the same time, the ship received another message, this one directed to all British ships and sent in a special Admiralty code reserved for merchant vessels. Once decoded, it too was delivered to Turner. The message warned ships in the English Channel to stay within 2 miles of England's southern coast, but ordered those ships en route to Liverpool to avoid headlands, stay in mid-channel, pass the entrances to harbors at high speed, and finally take on a harbor pilot at the Mersey Bar to guide them to their wharves in Liverpool. The message ended, submarines off Fastnet. Coming one after the other, the 2 messages were disconcerting and confusing. The second seemed to contradict itself. On the one hand, it advised ships in the English Channel to stay close to shore. On the other, it recommended that ships on Turner's route stay in mid-channel. It urged captains to race past harbors, but at the same time told them to stop and pick up a pilot at the entrance to the Mersey River. Nor did these messages offer any clue as to the actual number of submarines or their precise locations. The waters off the south coast of Ireland formed an immense expanse of ocean. The phrase, submarines off Fastnet, could mean 0.5 mile or 100 miles. Together, the 2 messages suggested waters teeming with U-boats. For Captain Turner, one fact was certain. The Lusitania would be passing the Fastnet Rock the next morning, and would be off the south coast of Ireland for the remainder of the voyage to Liverpool. After dinner, Preston Pritchard led the night's whist drive in the second-class lounge, while in first class the evening concert got underway. The night's program has vanished from history, but one passenger reportedly dressed up as Bonnie Prince Charlie in full Highland regalia and sang six Scottish songs. On past voyages, passengers recited poetry, displayed their skills at legerdemain, read aloud from books, and gave comic recitations. They sang songs like Down by the Old Mill Stream, Genevieve, and Tip Top Tipperary Mary, and they showed off their instrumental talents with solos on the euphonium and mandolin and cello, Godard's Berceuse de Jocelyn and Schumann's Träumerei. There was one regular feature. Each concert ended with the audience standing to sing God Save the King and its American cousin, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. Same tune, very different lyrics. It was here, during intermission, that Turner stepped forward to offer his sobering remarks about submarines and the war zone, and assured the audience they would soon be securely in the embrace of the Royal Navy. While the concert was underway, a team of officers conducted a night inspection of the ship, another measure prompted by the submarine threat. In addition to wanting all portholes closed, Captain Turner now ordered that they all be curtained to prevent the escape of light, and that all doors that led to outside decks be closed. Turner also turned off the ship's running lights. The inspection team, led by Senior Third Mate John Lewis, checked all the portholes and windows in public rooms throughout the ship, and those that could be examined from the decks, but Cunard rules forbade the men from entering staterooms. The inspection team left a list of open portholes for the room stewards, tucked into a corridor light fixture. Passengers had been instructed to keep their portholes closed, but the weather was so mild that many opened them for ventilation. Book dealer Charles Laureate made it his business to observe the inspections and other shipboard operations. I was keenly interested in all that was done aboard ship as we approached the Irish coast, he wrote, and in fact, all through the voyage I kept my eyes unusually wide open. That Thursday night, as he walked to his room on B deck, which, being an interior room, did not have a porthole, he saw the list of open portholes stuck right in the lantern as you walk along the passageway. Captain Turner's concern about open portholes was shared by all captains, whether in peace or war. A porthole was just what its name indicated, a hole in the side of a ship. Under certain conditions, a single open porthole could admit water at a rate of 3.75 tons a minute. That evening, a group of passengers got together and formed a committee to teach one another how to put on the new body life jackets. These being of a different pattern from the usual cork waistcoat, said passenger Arthur J. Mitchell, a representative of the Raleigh Cycle Company. Mitchell had reason to be concerned. In his travels thus far, he had survived two shipwrecks. Captain Turner approved the idea, Mitchell said, provided that no suggestion would be made to the passengers that the use of the preservers was in any way imminent. There was enough unease as it was. A first-class passenger named Josephine Brandell, 23 years old, was so frightened she decided she could not sleep in her own cabin and asked another passenger, Mabel Gardner Crichton, 42, if she could spend the night in hers. Mrs. Crichton assented. Wrote Brandell, she was only too happy to be of any assistance to me and did all she could during that whole night to quiet my nerves. The ship's Marconi room now received a new message, this of a different sort. It was for Alfred Vanderbilt, from a woman. It read, "Hope you have a safe crossing. Looking forward very much to seeing you soon. London, Washington, Berlin. Tension. News of the sinking of the candidate took time to reach the Admiralty. A trawler, the Lord Allendale, stumbled across the ship's three lifeboats at about 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon. The men had been adrift in the fog for 5 hours. The trawler was not equipped with wireless and so could not report the sinking or the rescue until it returned to its base at Milford Haven on the English coast, far from where the candidate had sunk. The commander of naval forces at Milford Haven notified the Admiralty of the attack in a telegram sent shortly after midnight. A telegram from the Queenstown Naval Center came in that day as well, with another report of a submarine sighted off Daunt Rock, this one at 9:45 that morning. The U-boat had remained in sight for 5 minutes before submerging. This was relayed to Director of Intelligence Hall as well as to First Sea Lord Fisher. A copy also was circulated to Churchill's office, though he was still in France. The HMS Orion continued on its way north, zigzagging in open sea, 150 miles west of Ireland. In Washington, President Wilson struggled anew with depression. Edith Galt's rejection had cast him into a state akin to grief, to the extent that he found it difficult to concentrate on world events, though these continued to press. The Gulf Light was still major news. An inquest by an English coroner had confirmed that the ship's captain, Alfred Gunter, had died of heart failure, accelerated by shock, caused by the torpedoing of the ship. The Gulf Light's second officer testified that the submarine captain had to have realized the ship was American, for the day had been clear and the tanker was flying a large American flag. There was also news of fresh U-boat predations. The Washington Times reported on Wednesday evening that a German submarine, running amok, had sunk 11 unarmed fishing trawlers in the North Sea off England. That night, however, Wilson's attention was focused solely on Edith. He resolved that despite his new grief, he would not, could not, let her exit his life. He composed a long letter, really a prose poem of despair, in which he, the man so many Americans thought of as distant and professorial, wrote, "There are some things I must try to say before the still watches come again, in which the things unsaid hurt so, and cry out in the heart to be uttered." He was willing to accept friendship, he told her, for now. "If you cannot give me all that I want, what my heart finds it hard now to breathe without, it is because I am not worthy. I know instinctively you could give it if I were, and if you understood the boy's heart that is in me and the simplicity of my need, which you could fill so that all my days would be radiant." He made it clear that she would come to love him. "Do not misunderstand," he added, in one of three impassioned postscripts. "What I have now at your generous hands is infinitely precious to me. It would kill me to part with it. I could not, and I hope you could not. And I will be patient, patient without end, to see what, if anything, the future may have in store for me." Not so patient, as it happened, for the next morning, Thursday, May 6th, before sending off this letter, he added a codicil that was 5 pages long. He had read her letter again, he told her, and now appraised it in a more hopeful light. "I can hardly see to write for the tears as I lift my eyes from it, the tears of joy and sweet yearning." For the time being, he chose to position himself as her knight. "I seem to have been put into the world to serve, not to take, and serve I will to the utmost, and demand nothing in return." Edith's resistance, meanwhile, had begun to waver, but amid a crush of conflicting anxieties. The fact Wilson was President of the United States placed a barrier in her thoughts that she found hard to overcome. His power, his ever-present detail of Secret Service men, his visibility in the public eye, and corollary restraints on his private behavior all complicated matters, as did the simple fact that any woman inclined to marry Wilson was likely to have her motives questioned, given his high office. There was the fear, she wrote, that some might think I loved him for that. Then the terrible thought of the publicity inevitably entailed, and the feeling that I had no training for the responsibilities such a life held. On the other hand, she felt deep affection for the man. Oh, so many things swarmed in my thoughts, she wrote, and yet each time I was with him, I felt the charm of his presence. She was enthralled, too, by the trust he placed in her and his willingness to discuss with her all the problems which confronted him and the fears, even then, that the fires of war raging in Europe might leap the Atlantic and involve our own country. They could not see each other too often, lest they draw unwelcome publicity, she wrote. And when they did see each other, it had to be at the White House, or during a drive with a chaperone always at hand, whether Helen Bones or Dr. Grayson or Wilson's daughter Margaret. A car full of Secret Service men invariably followed. The only wholly private means of communication was by mail, and so their letters continued, his ever passionate and filled with declamations of love, hers welcoming and warm, but at the same time curiously distant. In Berlin, Germany's Chancellor Bethmann was growing increasingly perturbed. The war in the trenches was not going well, and he feared that Germany's U-boats might make things much worse. A month earlier, Kaiser Wilhelm had issued an order that permitted U-boat commanders to keep their vessels submerged when attacking merchant ships, in order to avoid the danger inherent in surfacing and approaching suspected enemy freighters to first confirm their identity. The effect was to give commanders still more freedom. Combined with improved spring weather at sea, this had led to a startling increase in attacks on neutrals, like that against the American tanker Gulflight. On Thursday, May 6th, Bethmann wrote a letter to Germany's top naval official, in which he complained that over the preceding week, U-boats had sunk more and more neutral ships. This fact is eminently bound not only to alter our good relations with the neutral states, but also to create the gravest complications, and finally, to throw those states into the enemy's camp. The Empire's situation was tense enough as it was, he wrote, and warned, I cannot accept the responsibility of seeing our relations with the neutral states further worsened, to which the pursuit of the submarine war in its present form will certainly lead. He demanded that the Naval High Command take necessary measures to guarantee that our submarines will, in all circumstances, avoid attacking neutral ships. That evening, the Washington Times reported that four more ships had been sunk, including two neutral steamers and an English schooner. Two of the ships had been attacked by submarines. The other two were destroyed by a sea mine and shellfire from a German warship. The Lusitania was now 2 days out from Liverpool. At midnight that Thursday, May 6th, the powerful German transmitter at Nordic broadcast a message to all U-boats that the Lusitania would begin its return trip to New York on May 15th. This message was intercepted and relayed to Room 40. U-20. Fog. Schwieger and his crew spent a peaceful night far out at sea. At 5 o'clock Friday morning, May 7th, He ordered the submarine back to the surface and climbed into the conning tower. He shifted to diesel power and began charging the batteries below. At intervals, U-20 passed through mist and clarity. From time to time, it clears up a little, Schwieger wrote. These brief periods of clearing at first gave hope of better visibility to come, but soon all sunshine disappeared, and the fog returned as dense as ever. It was discouraging, and affirmed Schwieger's earlier decision not to proceed to Liverpool. He later recounted the story of that morning to his friend and fellow U-boat commander Max Valentiner. The heavy fog allowed small chance of sinking anything, Schwieger told him. At the same time, a destroyer steaming through the fog might stumble over us before we knew anything about it. Schwieger wrote in his war log, since the fog didn't subside, decided already to begin the return trip now. He set a new course for home. As far as he was concerned, this patrol was over. Part 3. Dead Wake. The Irish Sea. Engines above. Early Friday morning, a number of passengers awoke and dressed and climbed to the topmost decks to watch the sun come up. Although sunrise would not officially occur until 5:30, already the eastern sky was beginning to brighten. Elbridge and Maud Thompson of Seymour, Indiana, both 32 years old and traveling in first class, were in position by 4:30 a.m., as were second cabin passengers Bell, 49, and Theodore Nash, 59, of Kansas City. At about 5, the two couples spotted a warship off the port side, distant, traveling fast on a course parallel to the Lusitania. Mrs. Thompson called it a battleship, though in fact it was the HMS Partridge, a high-speed destroyer with three funnels. Aboard the Partridge, the officers and crew of the early morning watch also saw the Lusitania. For early risers like the Nashes and Thompsons, the sight of this robust warship was a comfort. Its presence affirmed the reassuring remarks Captain Turner had made at the previous night's concert. Said Mrs. Nash, "We had been told that we were protected all the way by warships, wireless, and that submarine destroyers would escort us in the channel." By channel, she was referring to the St. George's Channel. The Partridge had no such orders. The destroyer, capable of making over 30 knots, continued past at a brisk pace. At about 6 a.m., the Lusitania encountered heavy fog. Captain Turner reduced speed to 15 knots and ordered the ship's foghorn activated. Like other passengers aboard, the Nashes had a penchant for timing things, a function perhaps of the fact that there was little else to do aboard ship. They clocked the blasts of the foghorn at 1 a minute. Theodore found the horn unsettling. "I do not like this," he told his wife. "It is too much like calling for trouble." Throughout the ship, passengers awoke abruptly, and upon looking out their portholes and windows, saw only a milky blur. Charles Laureate stayed in bed until his usual shipboard wake-up time of 8 o'clock, then got up and took his usual sea bath. This morning he had little enthusiasm for the process. "As the horn was blowing and the weather was thick, I returned to my berth for a few hours' extra snooze. I instructed the steward that if he didn't hear from me by 12 o'clock he was to call me, as that would give me ample time to get ready for lunch at 1. The foghorn seemed not to bother Laureate, possibly because of his inside room and its lack of portholes. Captain Turner placed extra lookouts to watch for other vessels. One of these was Leo Thompson, a crewman assigned special lookout duty for the 2-hour watch that began at 10 a.m. He climbed the ladder to the crow's nest, about 1/3 the way up the forward mast. There he and another crewman, George Clinton, were to spend the next 2 hours staring into the fog, sometimes with marine glasses, Thompson owned a pair of his own, sometimes just with the naked eye. It was tedious but crucial work.